Welcome to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks to VJ Pandian for joining us in the studio today. He is horticulture agent and educator for UW Extension in Brown County. I'm going to talk with him about spring frost damage and how to get your soil temperature up. And, of course, he can answer any of your gardening questions. So, do you think you've had frost damage to your plants? What do you want to know about warming up your soil? Give a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And VJ Pandian, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
So what are the conditions when frost damage will likely occur?
Well, you know, when we start to have an early warm spring, what happens, most of the plant will start to lose their hardiness, actually. Once they start to lose their hardiness, when the bud starts to break out, that is the most crucial time because the plant doesn't have any more hardy tolerance, actually cold tolerance. That's a time we're going to see some freezing injury on most of the young tissues, including the flower buds, actually.
And the plants, you know, my own experience, pepper plants, for example, are plants that you don't want to have. you don't have frost or a cold snap.
Especially, and I like even magnolias, actually, some of the early bloom magnolias. Apricots, though the apricots are hardy for our area, but the blossoms actually bloom up somewhere like in mid to late April. So they're highly vulnerable for frost damage. And, you know, similarly, many other plants actually, even blueberries, kind of a little bit iffy if you do plant some early blooming blueberry plants too. So most of the cool season crops, they have some quite a bit frost tolerance. You're talking about cabbage, cauliflowers, and things. Now, the difference is actually the light frost, the light freeze, usually we'd say a temperature from 29 to 30 degrees, 31 degrees. Moderate from 25 to 28. But suddenly, if you do have a hard freeze or the temperature drops beneath 25, that's going to be causing more damage to even your cool season crop that you're going to have in your garden. And so the crucial time is that somewhere like from mid-April to mid-May, that's a time the gardeners should keep an eye on to it. And if the buds are starting to break open because of the warm spell, that's a pretty good chance that, you know, by, you know, mid-May, there might be suddenly a drop in temperature. Many of the young flower petals may not have that cold tolerance. And you're going to see a lot of freezing injury during that time.
And what does it look like, the injury?
So the injuries will be a sudden wilting of your leaf tissues as well as your flower petals. Pretty soon, they're going to see the tissues turning into black in color. And so those are some common symptoms, actually. But usually the young leaves, you know, though they wilt and die, the trees will start to produce some secondary leaves. But however, the major damage is going to happen in your flower petals. So for ornamental plants, like including like magnolias or your cornelian cherry dogwoods, okay? So if you lose the flowers, actually, then probably they're not going to rebloom right away, producing a second flush of the bloom. So you're going to lose its beauty, actually.
Yeah.
And the major one is going to be in your fruit crops. So like talking about apricots or probably your blueberries, okay? Or even sometimes early blooming apples, okay? So that's going to cause some major economical damage for fruit growers or even for backyard gardeners.
So, you know, we're getting pretty darn good at knowing what the temperatures are going to be even a couple days ahead of time anymore. Are there things you can do to protect if you know there's something bad coming in the way of temperature? Is there anything you can do?
Watch your forecast every day. That's one of the main things. I mean, I was so thrilled about like last week in May, March, that the temperature was climbing up 55, you know, right around that range in Green Bay area. All of a sudden, you know, the temperature it dropped down actually. So this kind of fluctuation happens up, you know. So every day we need to watch out for the forecast, you know. So the few thing is that one of the best thing I would tell is that, like, beginning from mid-April to mid-May, keep your sprinkler system ready. Because a lot of time, you know, if you have a very dry soil, they tend to have some more cold injury on the plant tissues rather than actually wet soil. So if you tend to moisten your soil, the moisture tend to absorb, you know, the cold and releases a heat. So it gives you heat more than about 4 times. So if you have a moist soil, probably surrounding air will be about 5 degrees, you know, of warmness it's going to give you. So that's going to prevent any of the frost injury. So that's one of the reasons why in a commercial fruit orchard, when they know there is a threat of fog or a threat of frost, they turn on their sprinklers or, you know, they turn on their water gun and they start to, you know, water their plants actually. So the gardeners, if you do have an, you know, plant some crops early in the season, or if there is your beautiful magnolias that are already in bloom, so probably, you know, turning on your sprinklers would help. The second most important thing for gardeners is to have a floating row cover. It is one of the best tools for gardeners, actually. A floating row cover is a white polyester spunbond material. It's a light fabric, actually.
Yeah.
It will allow the light and air to get into it. But at the same time, it gives you warmness. It's like a warming blanket for the plant. It gives you, raises your temperature from 2 to 5 degrees, okay? So in case of a light frost, you know, you actually, you know, drape the blanket on the top of the plant. The best thing to do is to have a, some sort of like a temporary teepee around the plant and then throw the blanket on top of it, so it'll be more effective rather than just actually tossing on top of the plant directly. But in case of a sudden hard freeze, then double up the blanket, you know, the floating row cover. It gives you at least about 5 degrees of warmness to the plant. So usually you set your floating row covers, you know, early in the evening, and then in the about like late in the morning, you can take it back.
And those are relatively inexpensive, too. So it's really cheap.
Very cheap, very cheap. And it's very versatile. I mean, it's not only for your spring frost protection. If you do want to extend your, you know, crop in the fall or even all the way to December, you can use that in a floating row cover. Also, you know, if you do have any bug issue, especially your spotted wing drosophila on your raspberries or any other bug issues, probably you can also use this to protect your plant actually from those bugs.
Let's take some calls. Paul and William are waiting. Let's go to Paul in Swamigo. Hi, Paul.
Hi, morning. I always enjoy your show. I just wanted to get that in there.
Thank you.
I wanted to try some straw bale method of gardening this year, and I had two questions. One, is it safe to use green-treated wood for the boxes? I'm just concerned about arsenic leaching out of the wood. I know they used to treat with that. And the other one is, when you put the bales in, do you stand those on edge so the ends of the stalks are up, or do you lay them flat?
Ends up.
Yeah, the ends up. And then you actually have a 2 metallic poles on the 2 ends of those bale, and then you tie a string, okay, right across it so that the bale doesn't get blown off in case if you have a strong wind, okay? So it gives you added support, actually, you know, to the bales to hold on to the ground. So in terms of the wood, I mean, still, I prefer to personally use like a cedar lumber, actually, because it lasts longer. I mean, nowadays, the modern treated woods, actually, you can still use for gardening. I mean, those arsenic leaching type of wood was actually banned, actually, back in 2000s, okay? So nowadays, the modern treated woods are safe. But personal preference is that I still like to use some of these untreated woods, and especially like, you know, cedar lumbers last longer, actually.
And you can, and you really don't need to have them as sideboards. Were you thinking of them as sideboards, Paul?
I was thinking of going with sideboards, you know, to get them up, get the bales up.
Oh,
you know,
get the bales.
Gotcha.
I see what you're saying. Gotcha.
Then in that case, it doesn't matter, actually.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, you can use whatever you want for underneath.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there you go. And there's some good books out there on straw bale gardening. You really want to pay attention to how you get the bales seasoned.
Yes. So that is a 15 days process, actually, you know, a couple of weeks process to season it. So probably you need to use, some type of synthetic fertilizer, which is rich in, you know, nitrogen. And then you need to treat the bale actually every about every day, literally for the first week or so. And then probably you need to water them up really well so that, you know, so that helps in a partially decomposing the bale, and that provides a nutrient for your crop plant to, you know, thrive. But in case if you don't want to use your synthetic fertilizers, then probably you can use organic. But the problem with the organic, like blood meal or even fish emulsion, is that you might tend to attract some rodents, you know, because they stink. And so that could attract some rodent issues.
And there's you might go just online and type in straw bale gardening, getting your bale ready or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there's, I know Joel Carson's got a bunch of information on it on his website, and there are other ones as well. But good luck. I enjoy straw bale gardening, and I bet you will too, Paul. Thank you. William in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, William.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Love the show.
Thank you.
This year, I'm planning on doing a traditional Haudenosaunee Three Sisters garden, since I'm trying to become a little more self-sufficient with my own food production. And, you know, that involves planting corn, squash, and beans. And I'm just my primary worry is, you know, I have to say it, well, I'm primarily worried about the, hopefully the weather not turning on us, since last year I did a garden and nearly lost it due to a snowstorm hitting unexpectedly around this time. Yeah, so I'm just, would you say right now is a good time to start planting the initial phase of it, planting my squash, and then in about 2 or 3 weeks getting my corn underway, and then after that the beans? That way I can have everything all ready to go.
I mean,
the weather really hits.
It's kind of a little bit early to get started, actually. I mean, if I do want to plant my Three Sisters garden, I mean, I would see the corn somewhere like in mid-May, and then I would get a squash transplant, you know, somewhere like around like in first week in June, and my beans also right after that. I mean, if you do want to start actually indoor your squash, you know, plant, I would start them somewhere like in, you know, first week in May, actually. Because, and the other thing about, you know, when you're trying many of these squash or cucumbers or zucchini plants or anything, you know, these viney crop indoor, you have to be very sensitive about their roots, actually. They don't like their roots to be disturbed quite so much, especially when you're transplanting. So nowadays they use like earthen pots actually for planting them indoor. So when you plant them outside, you know, you don't disturb them too much. You dig a planting hole, you actually, plant them directly into the ground, you know, without tearing the earthen pot, and they will naturally degrade. But if you start to disturbing the roots quite a bit, then probably they could become so stunted. So to get back to your main question, I would start something with a corn directly planting in the ground, like in mid-May, and following with that by first week in, June, I would start with the squash in seeds, and then followed by the bean seeds.
There we go. Thank you so much, William, for calling. Appreciate your call. There's some pretty good extension publications, too, that someone who's interested in getting started in gardening and so forth can use for free online.
Yes, the learningstore.uwx.edu is a portal for a lot of extension, you know, publications, including for lawn and garden. And you will find, you know, a wonderful list of, you know, vegetable crop publications over there, including for the basics of vegetable gardening, written by Dr. H.C. Harrison. And he has a wonderful book for the beginners on starting a vegetable garden.
Let's go to Pete in Milwaukee next. Hi, Pete. Thanks for calling.
Hi. The gentleman in the botanical garden in Madison uses a black tarp to cover the gardens. I have a blue tarp, the typical blue tarp, and I'm just concerned if there's any chemicals in the blue tarp if I put on the blue tarp now until Memorial Day weekend for planting season.
So your purpose of putting a blue tarp is to raise the soil temperature? Are you planning on planting a crop? Are you going to use it for frost protection?
I'm doing it to prevent weeds.
Ah, to prevent the weeds, actually. Okay. So the main purpose of, you know, putting a tarp or any kind of like a plastic mulch, actually, you know, is you raise the soil temperature to a drastically to a quite extent that all the annual weed seeds will start to germinate. But there is not much of light penetration happens in, and it gets cooked up too much into the soil, and then they die. So that is the main purpose. So the black tend to absorb more heat compared to blue. So I still prefer to use, you know, a black tarp or black plastic mulch, okay, for smothering or killing up some of the annual weeds. Now, if you do have a lot of perennial weeds like thistles and things, sometimes the plastic mulch doesn't work because these weeds, sometimes perennial weeds could find its way to tear up the plastic mulch and could sneak out. But it does a fairly good job, actually, in preventing, you know, many of the annual weeds from germinating and competing with the crop.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller. Jane Rotunda, our producer. Dave Potratz, our engineer. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your flower garden, your vegetable garden today with our guest, Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Give a call with your questions or comments, maybe an experience to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. John in Appleton, we'll turn to you next. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning. Over the last couple of years, I've attempted to grow luffa squash for the luffa and, you know, the bass scrubber. And it's a 120-day squash. And I've never had a lot of success because of the length that it takes. So what I want to do this year is make a little portable hot box in the area so I can get the squash going early in the ground, because I've never had any luck transplanting squash, because it'll just sit there for about 2 or 3 weeks before it actually starts to grow again. So that's I heard the fellow earlier talking about getting a garden going this early, which is, yeah, a little early yet, but that's my way of that I want to try and get extend that growing season, because I'm up in Appleton, so
yeah,
just a comment.
Yeah.
So one thing, John, is that for many times the tropical type of vegetables like your squash, your cucumbers, okay, they need a soil temperature of 70-75 degrees. So, you know, sometimes, you know, in northeast part of Wisconsin, you get that 70-75 degree type of warm soil somewhere like mid-June or something like that. We don't even get it even in first week in June. So that's where, you know, you need to think about raising your soil temperature by using some sort of like, you know, a black plastic mulch or any type of, you know, methods to raise your soil temperature. And then you transplant them in the ground, and then you will start to get to see that the squash plus kicking off right away in the first week in, you know, June. So that is a key, actually, for, you know, to get start a head start for squash plant. So at the same time, you know, like I said to you, like I said to the other gentleman before, is that you have to be very careful in transplanting many of these squash plants. So try using earthen pots, and then you bury them into the ground rather than actually, you know, lifting it off from a, you know, your plastic sleeve and trying to, you know, plant them in the ground. If you do plant them, don't try to disturb the root ball.
There we go. Thank you, John. Appreciate it. And let's go to Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I got a question. I'm hoping your guest can comment on this. It might be a little outside of his area. But I had a birch clump that I managed to keep alive for like 35 years when all the rest of them in the neighborhood were dying. And finally, it kind of rotted off at the base, and I had to cut it down. Now, I like the birch clump where it was, and I'd like to plant a new one, but I'm concerned about rotten organisms in the soil, if I should move it somewhere else, or if I can do something to the soil to make sure I don't get this rot started in the new tree.
So, Mike, is your new tree is going to be again a birch, or are you going to think about a different tree species?
No, because of the style of the house and everything, I would like to get a birch. I would probably like to get a slightly different variety, this very, very shaggy bark thing that seems to grow wild down around Madison, but it's not what I had planted there originally.
Okay. So the birch tree, they don't have a long life expectancy in urban area. Even in the natural wooded area, they can live only about like 50 years or so. So in urban areas, so the thing about birch tree is that they get stressed out very easily. So their root needs actually a cool, moist, well-drained soil. And certainly in an urban area, when you stick it in the middle of the yard, and especially in a heavy clay soil, your roots actually get stressed out so badly, and then you become more vulnerable to bronze birch borer that comes and attacks a tree from the top, and actually it starts to, cause some other complications too. And birch tree also do get some rot diseases very easily, so you have to be very careful not damaging the trunk or the bark of the tissues, okay? So if you do want to actually replant that birch tree, I would stump grind it first, actually, if there is any stump, and then fill it back with the original soil, and then try actually, planting some a river birch, like heritage river birch, okay, rather than using a paper birch. Now, the heritage river birch, they do need a slightly acidic soil. So every spring, use some elemental sulfur and sprinkle it around the base of the tree to acidify your soil a little bit. A heritage river birch, is more tolerant to resistant, actually, I would say, to bronze birch borer.
There we go. And it's a pretty tree.
It's a very nice tree. I really like its exfoliating bark. Yeah. It's like a salmon color to it, and it gives you a very good winter interest in your landscape.
There you go, Mike. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Jan and Viroqua, thank you for calling.
Good morning to both of you. I left my old growth standing in my perennial beds, and I'm wondering, is now the time to be pulling it up, and should I be cutting it up, or can I pull it out, or how low should I go? Should I leave it laying on the ground, or should I bundle it up and, compost or recycle it?
So, many times people do in two different ways, actually, in trying to overwinter the perennials. Some people, they like to cut those perennials in a dead stock, like in late fall. And some people like to wait till about mid-spring, actually, to do that. So my suggestion is actually, wait till mid-spring. But do it before the bud breaks happens, before you see any new growth pops in, okay, from the crown. So when you do chop it, you leave about, couple of inches, you chop it a couple of inches above the ground. And then you clear off, you rake up all the dead stalks, and then you can either put in compost or you can trash it, whatever you can do. I would not let it back sitting in the ground, okay? I tend to rake it out most of the time just to prevent any accumulation of disease pose, habitating in the soil, over the years.
And if you leave it a little bit longer, it's not going to hurt anything. There's still some beneficial insects that may be in the debris.
It's possible. I know you can leave it a little longer too. It can act like a mulch too. And most of the native prairies, people don't cut those things actually in a natural, grown native prairies. So they will naturally, wither off, and then they act like a mulch and helps in protecting the roots and the crown. And also help in supporting many of the beneficial insects, like you said, Larry. But in a nice perennial, bed that you have in your front of your house, you don't want them actually piling up every year and after year, inviting your rodents and voles and to habitat that. So in those kind of scenario, it's best actually to rake those things out.
Absolutely. Jan, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Mary in Plover. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I always have a lot of trouble with potato bugs on my potato plants.
Yeah.
And I heard someone tell me that I shouldn't plant my potatoes until June because then I won't have so much trouble with that. Is there any truth to that?
I mean, you can delay actually planting, potatoes, but it depends upon the variety, okay? So if you delay it too much, then probably, you know, you may not able to get well-developed tubers, okay? So, so it all depends upon the, you know, timing when you're going to plant it. We still plant, actually, potatoes somewhere like in, you know, first week in May to mid-May, actually, those tubers when the soil is cool and moist. If you let to plant them like in mid-June or something, the soil starts to warm up and it gets really stressed out. So you won't see a good initiation of the tubers, you know, right at the time. So it's a very tricky thing. So the very first thing I would tend to do is actually do a crop rotation. If you've been planting potatoes every year after year, I would tend to break the life cycle and reduce the population of the potato bug by doing a crop rotation first, skip for at least 1 or 2 years, and then come back again and plant it. So that'll be my first preference. If you do have a historic, infestation of these potato bugs.
You know what I do, Mary? I've got the straw bale garden, and then last year's garden, of course, there's straw still left from a year before, and I put it all in a big pile, and then I throw my seed potatoes in the pile, and then that's it. That's how I do my potatoes. And it turns out pretty good.
I mean, it turns out really good even in raised bed gardening too. Yeah. We do have about 10 to 12 inches, you know, high raised beds. And we've been planting the Russian fingerling potatoes, you know, which is a short growing season potatoes, for at least two, three years in our old extension office. And it does fantastic well. I mean, we didn't have any issue with the potato bugs, you know, and we can harvest them as like midsummer, actually, those fingerling, Russian fingerling potatoes.
Yeah. I like those little purple ones from Mexico, I believe. South America, anyway. They're tasty. They're tasty. Mm-hmm. So there you go, Mary. Thank you for calling. On to Jay in Ocano. Hi, Jay.
Yes, I'm enjoying the show and a hot bowl of pea soup.
Good for you.
I have a question. I have some trees along the river. Not that I particularly care for them, except that they hold the bank up, so they're pretty valuable.
Yeah.
But they're just a scrub tree. Unfortunately, as they grow up, they start to block the view of the river. Anything that I can do to, you know, trim the tops off, because I don't want them to grow higher, but I don't want to kill it, because then I won't have that root system.
Do you know what kind of trees they are?
They're probably like a box elder or something like that.
Or a willow, maybe?
No, they're not a willow.
They're not a willow.
No. Nope.
Okay. First, make sure what tree you have. If it's a box elder tree, then I don't mind about it, actually, because though box elder trees are native trees, actually, but they are very aggressive, and they are very weak-wooded trees, actually. So when you do attempt to trim them, first of all, I would think that, you know, to hire a professional arborist to do the job, because considering the weak-wooded nature of the boxwood and how those branching structures could be very weak and vulnerable. So when we attempt to do any kind of crown reduction, we call, you know, gradual crown reduction. So let's say, you know, your crown is about like, you know, 30, 40 feet high, you want to get it back to about like 20 feet down. So you split it up actually in over years of 3 to 4 years, and you start to gradually thin them back to one of the lateral branches and spread that pruning to about, you know, 3 or 4 years. But this box elder trees, like I said, it's a very weak-wooded one. So you need to be very careful, especially in the branch collar areas, if there is any rot or anything happening up before you attempt to take any pruning saw to do any three-point cut method or something. So some of these things I would best leave it to a professional arborist to assess the tree and find out how safe it is to prune and let them do the job.
I saw a YouTube video just yesterday of a guy trying to do some trimming with a chainsaw right next to the river, and he fell into the river with the chainsaw running. That's, well, there you go. There's all kinds of things that can happen when you're not prepared to do it
Yeah, you know, it's not easy, actually. Many people think about, you know, pruning a, you know, a large-sized tree.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of things you need to take into consideration. It's not only about your pruning saw or your, you know, it's about, actually, how strong the branches are and where you're going to make a cut. And those things are very crucial. And every tree is different. You might think even the oak trees, you know, that we should not supposed to prune from now, even in the wintertime. We have to think about the ice accumulation on those trees. You need to think about how, what kind of, you know, damage happens, you know, into the tree. All those things, a lot of factors needs to be taken in consideration before you think about attempting to prune that particular branch. So a professional has those kind of experience, actually, and they do have the liability insurance too. So in case even if something happens, you know, to them, you know, you're covered, actually, in those things. So
yeah, but still, even when in Jay's case, he probably wants to, if he has, and even bringing in a professional, you're probably going to want to do it more gradually, as you say, like over a 3-year period.
Yeah, you don't want to do it all of a sudden in a single year, because what's going to happen, the tree is going to retaliate back against you because it has saved all this energy in, you know, in the over the winter time in its root system and its trunk. So when you do a drastic pruning, it's going to send out all the shoots back again, and then probably, oh geez, you know, you get to know a point. What did I do? Just like, you know, people trim the crab apple, they do actually, you know, your cookie saw cut, and then what happened? It's like a porcupine, all the suck water sprouts comes up, you know. So it, so you don't want to do like that, actually, on a box of the tree.
Or any tree.
Or any tree, of course.
For that matter. Jay, thanks. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Well, let's go to Jan in Nina. Hi, Jan.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a challenge with thistleweeds taking over a part of my landscaping, and this has been happening for several years, and I would like to find a natural way to get rid of them. You know, I realize that the roots are very deep. I've tried the, I forget what the mixture is, but the vinegar, the water, and the dish soap mixture, and tried to spray that on. But they just seem to keep coming back.
Do you know the type of thistle? Is it a Canada thistle? I hope not.
Well, it's two types. It's two types of thistles. I know that. It's one's got a really deep root, and one does not seem, has like softer leaves. And doesn't seem to have as deep of roots. The ones with the deep roots have the purple flowers.
Yeah, so, you know, of course you have a Canada thistle in your property.
That's too bad.
It's a very invasive weed. And Canada thistle spreads by rhizomes, and sometimes the seeds also do actually, you know, help in germinating them. So the natural way, that's a very toughest thing, especially when you're dealing with the invasive species.
Talking now, about several years here.
Yeah. So if you do want to, you know, control the Canada thistles, you know, here's my suggestion is, okay, the first of all, don't attempt to till your soil. By tilling your soil, you break those modified stem, which we call the rhizomes, and every single inch of those rhizomes helps in generating new daughter plant, okay? So don't attempt to do that. But there are a couple of things you can do. One, what our master gardeners have done in the old extension office where we are successful is that we have actually set some lot of, you know, cardboard sheets, thick cardboard sheets right in the, you know, alley as well as between the rows of the clock plant. And then we, on the top of it, we put the wood chip mulch. It helps in smothering them, actually, and gives us a little bit of period of time. Whenever it pops out and cracks through those cardboard sheets and pops out through the mulch, then we actually take a hand trimmer and we chop them up. Or you can use a simple vinegar solution and try to burn the leaf off. But you have to be very persistent for 3 to 5 years. Yeah. So what's going to happen is that by being persistent, by using a weed trimmer, constantly moving it down, or by using a vinegar solution, trying to burn the leaf down, you're actually depleting the energy, the food energy that has been stored in the rhizomes as well as in the root tissue. At one point, the plant reaches to a threshold level, it's going to give up its life, saying, oh, it's no more use. And then you will have a moderate to, you know, a moderate success in controlling your Canada thistle. But if you are in a situation, you have a historic level of infestation in one particular section of a garden, then in the case, you have to be very aggressive. And in those cases, your best solution is either you switch to another garden site or you think about treating it in a conventional way of using chemicals to prevent those, control those Canada thistles.
And Canada thistles are tough to control, even with chemicals. So they're very, very hard. I like your idea, though, of the cardboard, put a mulch over it, and then just cut them down whenever they come up.
One of my master gardeners, he went one step further. So in the main aisle in the garden, he actually put up a plywoods, too, because he don't want to come back again and using a weed trimmer, to do those things, okay? So he put up a plywood, and then he put up a rock gravel on top of it, so it's easy for him to walk and, for those kind of, or even carrying a wheelbarrow. So you can also take that kind of extreme measure on your aisles of in your garden. But between the rows, then probably your only savior is going to be either using a thick cardboard sheet and you try to bend it between the rows and put some mulch on top of it. Those going to be the best option. Or you can try using black plastic mulch, but the problem is they can tear through the mulch probably by midsummer.
Yeah, okay, they tear right through. Yeah. Yeah, there you go, Jan. So you got two, 3 years of work out of you, likely. But good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Kay in Prairie du Chien, it's your turn. Hi, Kay.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
Now, you have a limey. I'm trying to grow a lemmy.
Oh, you're trying to grow a lemon tree. Okay.
And I've got five already started. They're about an inch and a half or so high. Now, what all will I have to do is there any special treatment with that?
Did you start them from the seed from a lemon?
Yes, I did. A red lemon.
Mm. I mean, from my experience, I've been growing this in a lemon tree in our extension's greenhouse, actually. It's a citrus. And what I find, actually, it's a self-pollinating, it seems like.
Yeah.
So that's a good chance that, it depends upon, there's always a risk, a 5% of cross-pollination could take place, but that you may have end up in lemon. So one thing I would do, if it's growing in a clump, I would actually, in spring, be careful in transplanting them. I try to scoop out as much possible, and you transplant them in a bigger container. And, and once the temperature starts getting warm up outside, by mid to late May, you can actually set them in a little bit in a shaded area first, and then probably you can gradually bring it to a partial shade areas. And you can keep up with the fertilization schedule, like once a month, you can use some sort of like a slow release type of nitrogen based fertilizer, and then you can do. And then by late summer, like I'm talking like in late August, early September, I would start gradually bringing it back inside the house, okay? And at the time, I would start fertilizing and keep it a little bit in a bite, like in September, late September, early October, keep it near to a bright sunny window, actually. And watch out for your soil moisture at the time. You don't want to water too much when the plants are starting to, getting a little bit in a semi-dormant type of period, like beginning in like in mid to late fall. So you don't want to water too much. Let it dry out a little bit.
And when I have my limey, when limey's inside, I water probably once a week, and I don't fertilize with anything except fish emulsion fertilizer, and I just pour a little water in my jar, and then I put some fish emulsion fertilizer in there, and then I fill the rest of it up so it kind of gets mixed up, and pour that over the soil, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And limey is just finished with 25 limes or so, the last batch, and now she's flowering again. Mm-hmm. So we've got more limes coming.
Yeah, I mean, I got a couple of limes, and it's actually in bloom, and it has one of the most fragrant blossoms,
Oh, yeah, they're really nice.
It fills up the greenhouse, actually. It's so pleasant to action inside the greenhouse, you know, at a hat. So.
What lime, what species do you have, or variety?
I don't remember at this point, you know. I got it a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I have a Bears lime.
Bears lime, okay.
Yeah, Bears, two S's on Bears. Kay, does that help?
Yes, it does. Now, what's the soil that I should start? I've got it started in organic. It's a organic planting soil.
Yeah.
And that's what I've got it in. And also, I want to cultivate some thistle milkweed.
Yeah.
I'm going to put those on the north side of my house because it's more sun. Now, that's going to be a lot of sun. Is that going to be too much for them?
Not necessarily, but you can use a potting mix for your lime. I mean, that's what I had it. It should be fine. As long as you don't use any heavy soil, from your garden, you know, that's okay. It should be fine. So, yeah, I mean, if you do want to plant your milkweed seeds actually in the north side of your garden, yes, you can do that. They do like bright sun, actually. And certainly...
No problem.
It shouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, there you go, Kay. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Vijay Pandya, an horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Talking about, vegetable gardens and flower gardens. We've hit on trees, all things in the outdoors, I guess, with our guest today on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, my guest, Vijay Pandyan, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. And we have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jay in Pierce County, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry and Vijay. Say, I have a earthen conservation dam that's about 10 years old, and it got to the point where it was just covered with burdock and nettles.
Yeah.
So last year, I took Roundup, and I just laid waste to it. And now it's this spring, it's got a lot of bare patches where those weeds were. And I'm trying to figure out what I can plant there. It's about a half a day sun, east facing, in a valley, that would be a manageable cover to stop erosion there on the slope. And I had contemplated crown vetch, but I've heard crown vetch is not, recommended anymore.
No.
So I'm just trying to come up with ideas what to put there on that, to replace the nettles and the burdock, which I don't care for.
Yeah.
So you're going to have this issue with the nettles and burdocks, at least for another 3 to 5 years constantly. I mean, it's not going to be in a highly populated, like a thickly populated like that you used to have before you sprayed, but what you can do actually in terms of, renovating that section again, I would strongly suggest thinking about using some sort of like a native prairie mix actually.
Yeah.
And since especially, it seems like you are actually trying to create an ecological, sensitive area right in that spot, I think probably native prairie mix would go really well. I mean, there are a lot of different type of mixes available depending upon the type of soil, depending upon the sun exposure. So there are some mixture which are for full sun, so there are some mixtures actually for pot sun. So I would suggest, to pick up the mixture for pot sunny area. Neil DeBoll, has a wonderful website on his,
prairie
nursery.com. If you go to that website, he has a wonderful resource information in that website. So depending upon your site location, and you could pick and choose what type of prairie mix is more appropriate. So I would start that. So I would start interseeding that area with using that prairie mix, either by broadcasting, and then, by midsummer, I would also step in that actually to do some control measures of your nettles as well as your burdock. So don't let those nettles actually to get to the blooming stage at the same time with the burdocks too. Don't let them. Keep them trimmed up. Generally when you do broadcast with the native prairie mix, it's hard to differentiate which is a weed and which is actually the prairie one. So generally what we tend to do to control the weed is for the first 2 years is that you keep mowing those, site. So you give the native prairies by third year more better root establishment, and then they'll start to grow, very vigorously and have a upper hand against the weeds. Okay, so
there you go. I agree wholeheartedly. I think that's a really good idea for that kind of situation.
Yeah. And once you get that soil, conditioned, actually, prevented from erosion using native prairie mix, and depending upon how big the site is, then you can start thinking about maybe to have some native trees, actually, that are certain good native tree species that can also take a little bit in a medium to low slopy areas. You can plant some small size trees, down that too. So there are a lot of options available, but I would start to plan, have a 5-year management strategy, what you want to do. Don't get everything, get started within a single year to try to accomplish everything, okay? So spread it out in about 3 to 5 years, okay, and have some sort of a plan and map, and then go forward from that.
And thanks very much for calling, Jay. Appreciate your call. Mary in La Crosse, go to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I was just listening to the lady that's trying to grow a lemon tree from a lemon seed, and I am fairly certain that it won't produce fruit, which I assume is what she wanted. If she wants beautiful, glossy leaves, about 25 years ago, my grandson, who is now 29, planted three grapefruit seeds in his mama's ficus tree, and one has survived all these years. And I came by it because he's been in the military school and not settled, and hoping he'll get a house soon so he can take it. But it has turned into a real tree, and the leaves are absolutely beautiful, gorgeous, the citrus trees have. But it's been cut back so many times, and so it's actually fairly ugly. So if she wants a tree just for pretty leaves and to play with it, I would say, enjoy the process of what happens. But if she really wants lemons, she has to take your advice.
Yep. I would agree with you on that. I would, if you really want a lemon tree to produce lemons, I think you need to get a tree.
Yeah. The one of the toughest thing that I'm facing is actually the mealybugs on the lemon trees, actually.
Oh?
Yeah. I one of the lemon tree that I have in the greenhouse is fine, but the other ones start to have the infestation of that. And so I've been spraying with some mineral oil, the lightweight horticulture oil. Or you can actually take a cotton swab and actually, if this infestation is very small to minimum level, then you can use a cotton swab dipped in rubbing alcohol, and you can actually, try to get rid of this mealybug and that. That is one of the challenging things that I'm facing through. If you like to grow multiple, lemon seedlings or lemon plants, watch out for those mealybugs.
Let's go to Jeannie in Eau Claire next. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm trying to get a yard established for my girlfriend so that she can sell her house. And we started last fall, but we've been faced with an infestation of moles. And so with this spring, I'm wondering what you could advise us to deal with that.
So the first thing is to, find out, where that mound is. And usually moles, tend to build some mounds, in your yard. So, and then you can get a mole trap, actually. and then you can set it in. And you can go to any animal pest control, you know, companies, and or you can rent it from any hardware store, or you can actually shop for a mole trap. We do have an extension publication written by Dr. David Drake and Scott Craven's publication on controlling moles, and you can download that publication at learningstore.uwx.edu. That has a great information that talks about in details about what are some of the strategies that you can use to control moles in your backyard.
And usually one mole can make, I mean, you get a couple of moles can make it look like there's 20 of them out there. There's usually not that many.
Yeah, yeah. So usually a single mole can make a lot of mounds, actually.
Yeah.
It looks like sometimes. So they have all these underground tunnels, and looks like, you know, your lawn is in a catastrophe. It looks like someone has teared up and have all this kind of like a big, you know, mound hoopy filled with all the dirt on top of it, you know. I can see that, you know. It can turn to be very ugly. But I would strongly encourage you, you know, to find that extension publication on learningstore.uwx.edu and read through it. And there is actually a section on using mole traps.
And, Jeannie, does that help, Jeannie?
Yes, sir.
All right, good. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Always fun, isn't it? Oh, man. Our guest today is Vijay Pandian. Vijay is horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. And it's always great to have him with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mealer, and always appreciate you listening to Garden Talk. Are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mealer here with my guest, Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Gardening question, maybe a tree question. It could be flowers or could be vegetables, could be trees or shrubs. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We've got some emails here, but I before we go to those, strategies for warming the soil. What have you got? Some good ones?
Yeah. I mean, so the very first thing is to get to know what your soil temperature is. So many of the cool season crops, your broccoli, cauliflowers, you know, those transplants, you plant them when your soil temperature gets about 45 degrees. You need to have a minimum of 45. For tender crops like tomatoes and things like that, you know, peppers, tomatoes, you know, you need to have a minimum of 55 to 60 degrees in that range, okay? And squash and, you know, all those other ones, at least 70 degrees. So knowing the soil temperature is the first step before you start thinking about what strategy can be used for warming up. So for that, you don't have to invest in a very fancy tool trying to get like a big soil thermometers or something like that, you know. It's good enough to use your simple, you know, meat cooking thermometer. And you stick it in the ground about, you know, 4 to 6 inches into the ground. Wait for 20 seconds, you know, or 30 seconds till the needle stabilizes. And boom, you got your soil temperature. say, if you do actually, you know, need, especially people living in the shoreline area or in the low-lying areas, okay, by mid to late April, you know, if your soil still seems to be very cold, you know, then one of the best option is actually you can use a black plastic mulch. You know, you can use your ordinary, you know, your garbage, you know, bags actually too, and you drape it onto the your bed, and you dig a shallow trench so that you can actually bury the edges of those, you know, plastic mulch, and then you put some dirt on top of it to hold those bags. And let it sit for at least 1 to 2 weeks, and then you can start to measure the soil temperature again, see to what degree it has risen up. Usually about 1 week is good, but again, depends upon your air temperature also plays a part into it, how the weather is also going to play a part in affecting your soil temperature too. So 1 to 2 weeks is good enough. The other option is raised beds. Raised beds are fantastic, or planter boxes are fantastic. I remember, like, I started planting my transplants of my, you know, kohlrabi and broccoli in even in late March in my planter boxes, which is about, like, you know, 12 inches above the ground. And the soil was very warm. It was like 45 to 50 degrees. And it was actually the side of my building. So it gets the, you know, radiated heat from that.
Yeah.
And people were crazy thinking about me. It's like, wow, it's like late March and he's still. And, you know, I also do have a floating row cover. Since if the air temperature drops actually to 25, then I put the floating row cover on top of the plant. By mid to late May, my cauliflower was ready. My broccoli was ready. That's like, unbelievable. I mean, some of the local greenhouse growers are thinking I'm crazy there, because they just started actually, they are selling their cabbage and cauliflowers, and they're saying my cabbage and cauliflower is ready. It's like, raised beds and planter boxes are great. You can get a head start with your gardening, you know, and it's an easy way to warm up your soil. You don't have to do anything. I tend to use simply a potting mix actually on my planter boxes. It warms us very quickly.
Jennifer, you're talking about soil temperature here. I think she's going to have to wait here, but maybe not. She's got some hyacinth bulbs she got for Valentine's Day in glass jars. Can she plant those outside right now? We don't know where she's, I'm assuming southern Wisconsin, but.
I mean, if it's a pre-chilled bulb, yeah, you can go ahead and stick it in the ground. It's going to take time. The bloom, you know, might be a little bit smaller compared to the regular one, yes. And if you do plant them, plant it about 6 inches beneath the ground.
And Leslie in New Berlin emailed about getting rid of thistles. She said she's had 100% success killing Canada thistles using Iron X from Gardens Alive. Very satisfying. The leaves turn black and die. And it's effective for Creeping Charlie, she says. Another bonus, it's safe for people and pets.
Yes. This iron product, which, you know, is actually is an organic product, and it's a high concentrated iron solution, you know. And so what we tend to use in your lawn, actually, to especially the Gulf Coast people, if they want to green up the lawn, you know, to make it to dark green, they use this, you know, iron solution actually. Now, a higher concentration of this iron HTDA product, you know, it can burn the leaf, but not necessarily it will kill the rhizomes. So, but, you know, over the years, if you've been very successful in knocking down those, you know, stems and, you know, the leaves, you're going to deplete the rhizomes actually, you know, from its nutrients, and then probably you're going to have a success in that. And it's also a pet-friendly product, and yes, certainly you can use those things. The only drawback is it's expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive, for sure. Richard in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Question about maple nuts. You see it in products, but I've never noticed nuts on a maple tree. Could you tell me what kind of maple tree it is and where they grow?
Maple nuts.
Hmm.
I have no idea.
Yeah, I have no idea either. My apology for that. The maples tend to produce the samaras, which we call the fruit pod. It's like a helicopter ring kind of thing, you know, but not as a nut. So I'm
not
really sure.
I wonder if it's a name for some other kind of nut. Maybe somebody else can call in and let us know. So. Maple nuts, yeah. Well, stay listening, Richard. We'll see what we can come up with. Kevin, in Gutenberg, Iowa, your turn.
Yeah, I was wanting to know what I got to have for a pH balance, what kind of vitamins, what I got to put in the ground to grow morel mushrooms. What kind of plant, what temperature.
Okay. Now, I'm not a mushroom expert, but I do know in northeast part of Wisconsin, that is a private company called Fields and Forest Products. They are in Pestigo, and you can go to their website. I mean, they are a very reputable company. So they do offer some training classes in growing mushrooms, you know. So maybe they may be able to provide some information about it.
Morels are... I don't think that they have a way to grow morels.
Yeah, indoor, yeah.
Morels just...
outdoor.
Well, they're outdoors, and they're also, for some reason, people have very poor success growing morel mushrooms, which is why they're so expensive in the spring when they do come up in the wild and people pick them. So... Field and Forest was the name of the...
Yeah, Field and Forest Products and Pestigo. So if you Google up, they will find out.
Believe me, if they don't know, there probably isn't anybody else who knows either. Field and Forest Products. All right, there you go, Kevin. Thank you. Let's go to Carolina in Hayward. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I got a birch tree in my yard, and there's a lot of holes in it. Looks like a woodpecker would been working on it. Like in the middle of the trunk, I mean, hundreds of holes.
Mm-hmm. Say, obviously, there are two things happening out. But the primary reason is you might be likely, if it's a paper birch, you might have the bronze birch borer working on its way. And this yellow-bellied sapsucker bird, you know, it's a woodpecker type, you know, it senses that it's some sort of like a larvae hidden underneath the bark. So it's trying to hunt it down. And that's why you're seeing all this, like, you know, the holes line like a military army troops, okay? And so it's trying to hunt it down. So first of all, you know, I think that particular branch or that particular tree is in declining phase. So you may need to call an arborist to think about to take down that particular section of the branch or that particular section of the clump. And, you know, take a look and assess the entire tree. Is it safe to have the other clump still in? Because sometimes, you know, when you have multiple clumps coming up from the single trunk, by being one, the other one, you are disturbing the balance of the tree. So maybe an arborist may say that it's best to take down the entire tree considering the severity of the infestation and how the wood strength is going to be and how it's going to affect the balance of the tree as a whole from the architect perspective. So I would strongly encourage you to contact a certified arborist. In case, if the level of infestation is minimum, then you can think about, you know, treating your tree using and some sort of like a, you know, systemic product, and then you can drench around the base of the tree too. So call an arborist to assess the health of the tree and then go from there.
There you go, Caroline. Thank you very much for calling. Bob in Shawano County, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning. It's afternoon, I guess. Hey, first thing, I just make a comment. I think maple nut is flavor with maple syrup and walnuts. It's used in ice cream all the time.
Oh, so okay.
Might be the answer to that. My question is, I'd like to start some birch trees from seed. And I have lots of seeds, but I'm not quite sure where to go from here. I've heard of something about layering.
Yeah.
So... any time when you're collecting a seed from a deciduous species, you know, they do need to be subjected to a chilling period. So usually you start to collect the seeds in fall, and then actually either you could actually put it in a cheese bag and then you bury it in the ground about 6 inches deep. And then in the spring you take it off, and then you can actually grow them, you know, inside a small hoop house, or you can, you know, have a raised bed, you know, which has a well-drained soil, or, you know, and then you can spread those seeds up, and then you'll start to get some new seedlings popping out, and then you can transplant them. So Make sure that, you know, the seeds have been subjected to a chilling period. Chilling period usually refers to that, the temperature from about in the range of, you know, 32 to 45 degrees, okay? And so that they can break their dormancy and they can start to germinate. So that's very critical for many
different. And how many weeks do they, I mean, could you stick them in the refrigerator for?
For many species, they need a minimum of 2 months. Of chilling period. If you do want to place them in your refrigerator, you would put it actually in a bag of peat and then you stick it in your refrigerator. Don't stick it in your freezer, but just in your refrigerator.
All right, there we go. Bob, good luck. Appreciate it. So if it hasn't had that cold period, then get it in some peat, stick it in the fridge for two months. And that wouldn't be a bad time to then get them going.
Yep. Yeah.
Terry in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Going to embark on Raised Dead this year with just pitiful gardeners, I guess. We're going to try and control the weeds a little better. I'm looking for the trough as far as we're thinking 8 feet by maybe 24 wide. And I'm not sure on how deep. And then the soil content, what types of soil should we use? Because currently we have very clay soil in the ground, so we want to make our own.
Okay. So typical raised bed gardens, you know, are usually, you know, 4 feet by 4 feet. Now, the length could be as much as long as you want. But the width typically should be a maximum 4 feet because your arm from one end to other end stretches to actually only about 2 feet. So you don't want to step into the middle of the bed to harvest or clean up something because you're going to compact the soil. Now, there are two different versions of soil mixes that you can use. Now, I had pretty success with using a soilless mix, which comprises of compost, peat, and perlite. 1:1:1 ratio. So compost, you know that. Peat, you can get a bale of peat, you know, very easily at cheap price. Perlite is this kind of the byproduct of volcanic material, which is light and fluffy and white in nature. You can mix those things. So the perlite might be a little bit expensive, but, you know, again, it's an optional. If you find it's too expensive to get a big bag of that, then probably just go with compost and peat. Mix them up really good and you put it into your raised beds. Now, the other option is you can use topsoil. You have, you know, good quality topsoil too. You can use one part of topsoil, one part of compost, one part of peat mixes together too. Or you can just simply go with a compost and topsoil. Now, the downside is this. If you do use a soil, what happens after second or third year is that the dirt naturally starts to get settled down. In those cases, then you may want to think about using some sort of like a garden trowel or some way to loosen up the soil again to do that. Whereas in a soilless mix, you don't have to worry about any kind of using a garden trowel. You don't have to. You can directly, you know, stick your finger into it and you can plant the seed right away. So, but that also has a downside. During a hot, dry summer time, things dries out much faster, which means that you have to double up your watering schedule right up there. So those are pros and cons in both type of version. The depth, ideally, I like to go about minimum of 10 inches deep. But, you know, you can go as even as 12 inches deep. But don't go any less than 10 inches deep, because if not, you know, the plants will be already, you know, too much stressed out because of lack of moisture there. I know that, in a typical raised bed garden book that Mel Bartholomew written that, he recommends 6 inches. We tried 6 inches. It doesn't work for us, actually. So I think 10 inches, it seems to be ideal. And we have grown potatoes there. We have even grown sweet potatoes there. It works perfectly well.
There we go, Terry. Does that help?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Diane, in Cornucopia.
Good morning. I'm calling about some Annabelle hydrangeas that I planted about 4 or 5 years ago, and they're doing great. But the blooms get as big as dinner plates and flop. Is there any way I can prune several times before they come into bloom to reduce the size of the bloom on them?
If you do that, probably you're going to we might actually, you know, prune some of the flower buds. So annual hydrangeas, typically they bloom in the current season wood. Okay. So that's one of the reason why in early in the spring, you mow them down to the ground, all the dead stalks and everything. Okay. You cut them all the way down to the ground. Now, one of our grower, you know, who I attended his session long, long time ago, what he found out that instead of moving all the way to the annual hydrangeas back to the ground, he recommends actually cutting them down about 6 inches above the ground. So the stalk actually will send out some new shoots, and that can give you actually a little bit more stability to the stalk to hold the blossoms actually. So I never personally tried it, but he said that he was very successful. You know, instead of cutting all the way down to the ground, he leaves a stalk about like 6 inches above ground, and the new wood comes in from that, and that gives a little bit more strength actually for the new stalk to hold the bloom.
At our lake home, we had a nice bed of hydrangeas, and just like clockwork, a nice wind would come along. Just when they were blooming really nicely and knock them over. There were times when I actually ran some material out there to hold mm-hmm. them up and, you know, staked them up a little bit, and that helped. But I've kind of given up on them just because I get so mad about it. Oh, there you go, Diane. Jennifer emailed, I have a whole bunch of amaryllis bulbs. Can I put them in a shaded spot during the summer season?
Yes, you can do that. We can also plant them even actually in full sun too. So if you have them, amaryllis bulb already in a container, so you find actually a pot shaded or even a full sunny area, you dig them in the ground, you bury the container, or you can directly plant them in the ground too. And then before, you know, early fall or late summer, you know, dig them out of the ground, and then you actually start to cure them up. So during in the summertime, make sure to fertilize your amaryllis bulbs so they get a little bit fatter and they get all the nutrients they want. And then probably, you know, they will start to bloom again for the next season.
I know you visit the Green Bay Botanical Garden pretty often, mm-hmm. and they have quite a magnolia collection.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
So the man who is behind this magnolia collection is Mr. Dennis Ledwina.
Yeah.
He passed away a few years ago, and he is an awesome worldwide breeder. We are lucky to have him actually in Green Bay, and his house is not too far away from Green Bay Botanical, and we had a privilege of actually touring his collection in his house as well as at the botanical garden with our master gardeners. It's a wonderful, you know, collection he had. So one of the things that he is actually, you know, promoting is to have some blossoms that blooms late in the season. So one of the variety that I really like about is this rosemary magnolia, which is a sausage type magnolia. He named it after his mother, actually. It has a gorgeous blossoms. It looks like as if like a water lily blooming on every single terminal ends of the branches.
Wow.
And it's a late bloomer, so you don't have to worry about frost nipping it out. So it's one of the best variety that I think personally, you know, like to have it in my backyard. I mean, it's more upright growing. It's a small to medium-sized tree. So it's one of the best-looking magnolia trees that I still like it.
And what's the name of it again?
Rosemary.
Rosemary.
Yeah. He named it after his mother, so...
And to see them in bloom then is, again, when?
I would say probably about, like, you know, late May, first week in June, you know, first week, something like that, first or second week in June, you can start to see that. It's a late bloomer. And it's a prolific bloomer, and the blooming will last for quite a long period, you know.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Well, on that happy note, VJ, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
VJ Pandian is horticulture educator for UW Extension in Brown County. Always great to have Vijay and other horticulture educators with UW Extension. They do a wonderful job, as do all of our guests that we have for Garden Talk. Great to have them along. Next week, Joel Karsten will be back to talk straw bale gardening. So I hope you can join us for that on the Ideas Network. And Monday, computer expert Peter Green will be back to talk about digital payment methods. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.